Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey listeners, Becky here. A quick content warning before we start. Today's episode contains discussions about films that involve sexual violence, fascism, the Holocaust, and footage or photographs of real deaths used in fictional films. If that's not for you, we completely understand. Join us again next week, where we'll look at two Jim Henson fantasy movies. On another note, we recorded this episode before the 2021 Oscar nominations were released, so we say only 5 women have been nominated for the Best Director category of the Academy Awards. We can now add Chloe Zhao and Emerald Fennell to that list, making it 7. Thanks, as always, for listening. Now, on with the show. A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher and Emily Gagné, the host of the We Really Like Her podcast, which celebrates women in film. She loves mother-daughter dramas and 80s slasher movies, and being from Toronto, Emily has programmed films for the Royal Cinema and the Review Cinema. But she doesn't just love movies, she also makes them. Her first short film, Best Friends Forever, which she co-directed and co-wrote with Josh Korngut, recently finished its festival run. And with that, we'd like to welcome Emily Gagné to the show. Eurovision is an event I look forward to every year. If you've never in earnest been down a YouTube rabbit hole watching the death metal antics of a demon-costumed band, followed by Russian babas dancing it out to a track titled Party for Everybody, that is my gift to you. Eurovision gave us ABBA and Celine Dion and Olivia Newton-John. In fact, coming in second to ABBA's Waterloo was an Italian song called Si, performed by Giliola Cinquetti. The story of the song is that there is a young woman who is falling in love with a man and saying si to spending the rest of their lives together in holy matrimony. In the song, she says si 16 times. Despite doing so well at the event, the song's presence was the reason that all of Eurovision was not broadcast that year on Italy's national broadcaster, RIA. Why? Well, in 1970, the majority of Italy's government was made up of the Communist Party and the Socialist Party, and they passed a law making divorce legal in Italy for the first time. But in 1974, there was a pushback by the now prominent Christian Democrats and the neo-fascist Italian Socialist Movement for a referendum to make divorce illegal again, you know, to preserve the nuclear family and all that. So the referendum was held just after Eurovision, and people were asked to vote, get ready for this, yes if they wanted to outlaw divorce, and no if they wanted to continue to be allowed to be divorced. Got that? So what does the song See have to do with it? Well, it's about a young woman who longs to be married, and there were concerns that See, being said so often, would subliminally influence people to vote yes for no divorce in the referendum. The proposal was defeated, and it remained legal to be divorced in Italy, although the rules would continue to change up until today. It's complicated. Now, this seems like a lot of context, but to discuss our two films today, knowing what was going on in both Italian politics and Italian feminism is really important. Women had a lot to fight for and against in the 70s. So let's get into Italian politics, Italian feminism, Italian cinema, and Lena Wertmüller and her masterpiece, Seven Beauties. Emily Gagné of the We Really Like Her podcast, where do you want to start?
I don't know about you guys, and I like... am newer to her filmography, but I was so like shocked, I'm gonna say, when I watched Seven Beauties. But like thinking about the time period really does make a lot of sense, and it does make sense that she would want to make such a bold political statement because there is so much unrest. You know, there was the feminist movement, Lotta Feminista was the name of the feminist movement at the time, that was sort of trying to suggest that women should be paid for their labor. And at this point, women were in the home doing this labor that wasn't considered important enough to be paid, which, I mean, is something that continues to this day. I don't know if that stuff is reflected in her work necessarily, which is something that I think we have to sort of talk about.
She refuses to even say she's a feminist, and that goes back to the 70s. Like, she doesn't think of herself as a feminist filmmaker. So it's interesting to bring up that history, because she was very vocal about being a director who happened to be a woman, and she wanted all of her films and her work to be viewed, be equal to men, male directors. So in some ways, that's the most feminist statement you can make.
Even though the main reason she does not want to be considered a feminist is because so many feminist critics who call themselves feminists have attacked her work as being deeply misogynistic, which when you watch it, you're like, oh, yeah, I can see that point
Pauline,
of view.
Pauline Kael was the main proponent of saying that she was a misogynist filmmaker. Pauline Kael hated her films.
But then you look at it from like the point of view of like, okay, she's coming from a communist socialist background where it's all about the symbology, and these people, it's not necessarily about their gender. It's more about who they represent within the society, what she's trying to say.
It's, I would say it's like slightly problematic, a little bit confusing, but I think that it, like, when I watched this movie, even though I didn't know that much about her aside from this movie, I feel like I really got a sense of who she is and what mm-hmm. she's about just watching this movie. And it's like her voice is very and it made me so interested to learn more about her. I mean, I think before this, what I knew about her was that she was the first woman that was nominated for Best Director at the Oscars. And that was sort of mm-hmm. it. Also, something that she's very famous for is her white glasses that she wears all the time, which I know seems something silly, but it is a signature. And she like wore them throughout her career.
Yeah, the documentary, there is a really good documentary. I can't remember who the director is, but it has like Martin Scorsese participating. And the name of the documentary on Lena Wertmüller is Behind the White Glasses, which is like, that's how iconic they were. They're so iconic that in 1976, which I guess would have been the second season of Saturday Night Live, Lorraine Newman actually impersonates Lena Wertmüller with the glasses, with Gilda Radner as Barbara Walters, because she had become so wildly and unprecedentedly, that's not a word, famous in America, which is not very common for most art house directors, and definitely not common for women directors. If you watch A Year in Film, the television version for our episode in 1975, you know, we talk about Jean Dillman by Chantal Ackerman, who's a Belgian filmmaker, and we talk about Joan Micklin-Silver's Hester Street. And these were big art house films that really made waves for feminist filmmaking. But what we you know, I'm glad we saved it for the podcast. The true celebrity was Lena Wertmüller. She was on a bunch of interviews. Italians were traveling to New York City and going into Times Square and seeing not just the poster for Seven Beauties advertised with lineups down the street to see it, but they decided, because to capitalize on the popularity, to release like all of her films. So Swept Away and Love and Anarchy, all the prior films. So in Times Square in 1976, you can see just Lena Wertmüller billboards everywhere. And that blows my mind, because there's very, you know, I think she's said that you only get really one Italian woman per generation who's famous, like Sophia Loren or Claudia Cardinale. For it to be her, I think, was very shocking to everyone.
And she also brought along with her Giancarlo Giannini, who looks like a classic Hollywood leading man, like a star, who also stars in Seven Beauties and Swept Away and would star in her American film, which flopped afterwards, that Hollywood basically abandoned her for. But let's get into a little bit of Seven Beauties. Emily, you this is the only one of her films you've seen to date?
Yes. I know, I feel ashamed, and I am so glad that you guys forced me to watch this. I will say, like, the other movie that we're talking about today, I was looking forward to more, and I liked this. I would say this was my favorite of the two films that we picked. It shocked me because it's such bold filmmaking, and I think it made a lot of sense when I started to look a little bit more into Lena Wertmüller's filmography and into her history. Like, hearing that, you know, this is a woman born in the 20s and she was obsessed with Flash Gordon comics, like that's where her understanding of the cinematic comes from.
Yeah.
And when I understood that, I was like, oh, this movie is making a lot more sense to me in terms of the bold stylistic choices, even the lighting. Like, there's a scene in Seven Beauties that has like this green lighting that
it's
feels
unbelievable.
Yes. And so I was really taken aback. And I mean, learning a little bit more about her too, like she had made like 8 films before she made, I think before she made Swept Away, which really started this crossover into the States. And then Seven Beauties was this like explosion for her. And then she had worked as an assistant director with Fellini on 8 and a Half. Mm-hmm. Like she was accomplished, you know? And I think that's such a trajectory for so many women filmmakers is like, you do this work and then you finally get recognized. I don't know, considering that I haven't seen a lot of her other films, like obviously I'm familiar with Swept Away because there was also an adaptation with Madonna, which was famous.
I love Lena Wertzmuller's response to that one where she was like, yeah, I just gave him the rights because I really like Madonna. I think she does amazing stuff. I don't really care what she did with it, but she's amazing.
Never ever watched it to this day.
Nope. Which totally fair. Totally
it's,
fair.
It's,
I
yeah,
wouldn't
it's
either.
It's one of the worst remakes probably of all time. And it's starring Giancarlo Giannini's son in the role that he played, which I think is, to Madonna's credit, she's trying to keep the spirit of Swept Away.
But I think it's like when you think about Madonna and her, I can see them being sort of like parallels in the sense that they're like bold and they're brash. And
iconoclasts.
They're like, yes. Mm-hmm. And they have a very specific vision of what they want to do.
And button pushers within that too, right? It's like, let's just throw a bunch of imagery that's going to piss a whole bunch of people off and see what
happens.
They
really like antagonizing the press in the same way, which I appreciate.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And it's kind of sad to see that Lena like almost made more of a transition to American cinema. Like she got this deal with Warner Brothers after she did Seven Beauties and she was nominated for so many things. And like you guys were saying, she was like playing in cinemas and her work was playing in cinemas all over America. But she made this one flop and A Night Full of Rain. Well, there's a longer title. She's famous for her very long titles and in fact has had like a Guinness Book world record title.
The most characters of any title. I think Seven Beauties is also titled like Pasqualino. Like it has a very long title as well. And we have chosen just to call it Seven Beauties as the American distributors did.
Yes. She made this one film, A Night Full of Rain, which co-starred Candice Bergen, and it just totally flopped so that Warner Brothers canceled her deal. And then she went back to making films, you know, in Italy, which I think probably in her sense, like served her better. And I read a lot of interviews with her where she said, you know, she did feel a little bit restricted working in the American climate because, as we know, you know, there are limitations and there are restrictions on what you can do and expectations about the boundaries that you can push. Like, to me, it's shocking that this movie, Seven Beauties, was the one that they were like, yes, this is the one that we want to reward, because it is like shocking, and I could see people even being very offended by it.
Well, I think we avoided saying what the film was about because it's the most difficult topic to cover. And I am not a Jewish person, and I want to acknowledge that I completely understand how the Jewish community and communities outside of the Jewish community, any community that was targeted by the Nazi party and fascism, this would be possibly very insulting, this film, because it is about, and most of it is set at a concentration camp. So we are introduced in the film to Pasqualino, played by Giancarlo Giannini. We see him essentially as a deserter. He's been fighting in the Italian fascist army. He meets another deserter and they are captured by, they find out that their train that they've jumped off of is in Germany, which is bad luck. And they are caught by the Germans and put in a concentration camp. We are then treated to sort of flashbacks through the perspective of Pasqualino on his very shitty, shitty life. And that's actually, that's how he describes his own life. He's, I've had a shitty life. And he really, and that is not to make you empathize with him, because as we will find out through this 2-hour film, he is a despicable figure. The film is called Seven Beauties because we are introduced to his character in Naples. And he's this, you know, prior to the war, this really, you know, hot-headed, thinks he's really, really the shit patriarch of a family. Now his father's died, he has his mother, and then he has 7 sisters that he's financially responsible for. And they, while the title of the film is Seven Beauties, it's very important to know that Vertmuller is very obsessed with grotesque, And the Carnivalesque and the Seven Beauties is a euphemism or an ironic nickname because he has absolutely unmarriageable sisters. They're so ugly. I say that, you know, that's the story. These women are not ugly. We don't think of women that way.
Not even remotely.
No. Now, his oldest sister has been prostituted by the man she's in love with. So Pasqualino murders him to save his family's honor. He does it in a stupid way because honor killings were legal at the time. And I think, Becky, you told me that they were legal up until 1981.
1981, that and restitution marriages.
Yeah, there's a number of documentaries made in Italy on restitution marriages that I would recommend viewers to see if you were at all curious about that horrific past to Italy, which is returning apparently. But so he kind of fucks up though, because he shoots the pimp while the pimp is unarmed, and then consults with the mafia, who are like, dude, like, you gotta wait until he draws, then you kill him, and then the judge will just say, hey, it's an honor killing, all good. So he's like, I think the best thing to do is to possibly cut up this corpse and put it in a suitcase.
Which is done totally slapstick, yes. And like to like a ba, 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 ba sort of
keeping
soundtrack.
Keeping in mind, this is still a film about concentration camps and the Holocaust. It has moments of slapstick. He gets caught by the police with the suitcase and the body parts, goes to jail. Now, and this is true, when the beginning of World War II happens, and of course Italy is on the same side as Germany, they give prisoners an option of commuting their sentence if they join the fascist army, which he does, realizes it's bullshit, not what it cracked up to be, or like what he was told it was going to be like. Here's where it gets really upsetting, because apparently this wasn't upsetting enough. He decides at the concentration camp that he wants to survive and that he's going to apply the same sort of allure that he applies to his life in Italy, where he thinks women will like fawn over him. So there is the warden of the concentration camp is a woman played by Shirley Stoller, who you're going to recognize from The Honeymoon Killers, probably most famously. Really famous character actress, very Rubenesque, very towering, like a large woman.
And a big presence, too. Like, she walks into that room and you're like, her, she's got something to say. Like, think Kathy Bates.
Yeah, yeah. And so Pasqualino decides to seduce her. This is probably the film's most famous scene. It's a scene that, I don't know how you felt about it, Emily and Becky, but I couldn't believe what I was watching. It feels impossible. He has to seduce this corpulent, very, and I don't say that as Shirley, don't say that about Shirley Stoller as a person. I mean this character, who is based on a real life character, Ilse Koch, who is known as the witch, or more commonly the bitch of Buchenwald, who was tried for her crimes and then killed herself in prison. You may have listened to our episode on Ilse She-Wolf the SS, which is a few episodes
back.
You may have skipped that one. Yes. It's the same woman that they're based on. 1975 was a big year. The seduction scene is bathed in neon light. It is filmed from a very low angle, so she looks very scary, and he has to have sex with her. And it's it's a sex scene for the books, let's just say. Like, I've never...
Yeah, nothing before, nothing since. And it's something that I think if you tried to recreate it, even in the concept of homage, you could never actually make it what it is. Yeah. Because it's simultaneously a parody and so deathly serious that you're just horrified and fascinated all at once. And that would normally be something I would actually skip forward if I was watching it casually, but I couldn't look
away. My memory of it is there's no music on it, which makes it very realist. And watching this documentary behind the glass, behind the white glasses, they interview Martin Scorsese and they interview a few other famous filmmakers and film critics. And they interview Giancarlo Giannini, who talks about this scene. And I was so interested to hear how he said they did it. Lena's commands to him was, we're going to do multiple takes of this. Sorry. We're going to do multiple takes of this.
Yeah.
And we're going to play one for slapstick, make it goofy. We're going to play one very serious. We're going to play like dead straight. We're going to play one that's kind of playful and seductive. And then when she went to edit it, she took one take from each. One scene or one kind of interpretation from each different take and then stitch them together, which is why I think this feels impossible, because the way both Shirley Stoller but more so Giannini play it is it encompasses every element of emotion and genre and style. And it's both grotesque but beautiful. It's both disturbing but kind of empathetic and makes sense. We hate this character by this point. He's raped a patient in an asylum. Like, you're not meant to like him at all. No. And yet, because it's such a, I guess because it's just such a universal will to want to live, to survive, that's how we empathize with him. And so he's just degraded to the point of crawling on his knees. And his award, his reward, other than a bowl of food, is she puts him in charge of deciding who gets shot in his own barrack. So he then has to choose which, Italian anarchists, or I would assume there's also Jewish people in this concentration camp, but they never really say that. He has to then assign who's going to die. Like, what a prize, right? The ending of this film, I'm not going to spoil, there's a big payoff. It's really what puts it in the realm of comedy. It's not just the farting corpse that he's trying to cut up and put in a suitcase, which I swear to God, that sequence lasts like 17 minutes of just this giant corpse farting. There's so much Looney Tunes in this film. There's so much cartoon. Yeah. And the idea that, in the 70s, art house filmmakers were looking at trying to grapple with the Holocaust. Think about the films of like Fassbender. Think about, Alain René. Like, this isn't the first film to try to depict concentration camps.
Well, and from a country that had concentration camps and was directly responsible for sending people there and trying to reconcile that history and being like, how do we even begin to talk about
this? And to make it Looney Tunes-esque and to make it a comedy and to make it this way, I do not know how to wrap my brain around what she accomplished. I don't know how to wrap my brain around how this was so successful. Like you were saying, Emily, I know that Giannini in this documentary talked about how they did the preview screening in Italy. Crickets, silence, didn't go well. Did it a few weeks later in New York, and the audience laughed at every single beat that Vert Mueller and Giannini wanted them to. So there was something that resonated with American audiences that did not in Europe. But what I will just point out is, if we're thinking about 1975 and New York as being the epicenter of, this is where all the art house cinemas were and where most film critics were located and publishing out of, there's a huge Jewish community in New York. There's a lot of survivors of the Holocaust who fled to New York.
I am still trying to wrap my brain around it as well, because it is so shocking. And this is a film that, like, I would expect to have like a cult following, but not to be this film that was not the first woman to get nominated for an Oscar. Yeah. It's kind of mind melting. But I think that there's also this other side of like traumatic things. Obviously, the Holocaust is one of the most traumatic, horrific things that's ever happened, especially in recent history. But I think like sometimes there is this like need to look at things with another lens, with a comedy lens or something like that, to take you out of it, because it's like, it's difficult to watch something like Schindler's List or even like Sophie's Choice, because it is so accurate to what was really happening. The thing that's confusing to me about this film is like, there are some moments that seem so harshly real, like scenes where somebody's getting beaten or somebody is like jumps into a vat of like
excrement.
human excrement and then gets murdered, effectively like shot at repeatedly. And then there's like this crazy sex scene, which I had so many complicated feelings about. Obviously, I'm also not a Jewish person. I'm like one of the whitest people ever. So I can't speak to it from that perspective. But as a woman, I found that scene so conflicting because I was so angry at him earlier when he raped that woman.
That's also another moment of silence, too. There's no music over top of that assault either.
It was really real to me. Like, it was interesting to contrast those two scenes, because that one felt so real. Like, and then the sex scene, later on, which I don't know if you can call it a sex scene. It's a manipulative sex scene. It had, like you were saying, has this sort of like artistic style that makes you drawn to it. So I feel like she's asking for us to have uncomfortable reactions and to be like, well, what is right and what is wrong? Like, you're disgusted by this, But at the same time, I was kind of intrigued by the second sex scene because I was like, how often do we watch these scenes with these men that are attacking women? And then this is another scene of a woman attacking a man. Granted, she is a Nazi.
Based on history, like based on something that really happened. I mean, this is what Ilse Koch is thought to have done. I think something that kind of helped me, and I don't remember where I read this. It's not my original idea, but someone pointed out that, especially in this film, she never judges the characters. She lets the audience try to judge the characters. And that's throughout her filmography. She never passes judgment. She just shows a perspective or a point of view. And I think I see that definitely in this film. It's maybe a good moment to point out, and this is not fact-checked. I can't remember where I read this, but at one point it said that she met an extra while making Swept Away, and that this was based on his life story, that he was a survivor of a concentration camp and a prisoner of war camp and that kind of thing. And so it's based on a real person, potentially, that she met within like her filmmaking context.
I think what makes it a little bit easier for me to consume is that, as I think I mentioned earlier, that these feel more like symbols than like people often. Yeah. The way they're sort of presented. And I found the same thing with Swept Away was I'm like, oh, I am looking at a representation of the working class and the bourgeoisie. So this makes it a little more palatable for me. And I think I found the same thing with this.
We're also not Italian. So like I will say, as someone who is a huge fan of Italian film, it's taken me many years to figure out the regionalism of Italy. So making a film that's, you know, set about a Nepalese person is very different than Sicily, which is very different than Rome, which is where Love and Anarchy takes place, which is very different than Bologna. Like, I'm trying to wrap my head around what that means. So to Italian audiences, that would have a ton of meaning. And I think to American audiences, that probably was lost unless they were of Italian descent.
I will just say that there is an opening that is quite arresting, which there's a lot of use of, oh, yeah, which I think is still something that's synonymous with Lena, because like even when I watched, she eventually won an honorary Oscar, even though she didn't win Best
2 years
Director
ago.
Back in, yeah, just two years ago.
2019 in the before times.
It's co-presented by two of the five women who have been nominated for directing Oscars.
Jane Campion, Greta Gerwig.
Catherine Bigelow, who won. Sofia Coppola.
Oh, Sofia Coppola, yeah.
And then Lena Wertmüller.
But when they were presenting it to her, I feel like it was either, I think it was Greta, because it feels like a Greta thing to say, that she said, oh yeah, when she was presenting the award to her. And I was like,
oh
that
my God.
Was perfect.
Starting this film, I was watching it and I thought, when you do that thing, you're watching on your laptop, although eventually I moved to my TV because I realized I wanted to see it big. I thought I had a music file playing in the background or like an ad. And I was like, what window is this? Why is this Oh Yeah song? What is happening? And then I was like, oh my God, this is how the film starts. What have I done?
The contrasting of that imagery, and you're seeing actual dead bodies. And then I think the part that I was just most like riveted by is how prescient that she discusses flat earthers. And it's intended in like a tongue-in-cheek sort of way about anti-intellectualism. But it's like, oh yeah, you just straight up brought up flat earth. Amazing. Like this is absurd.
This film accomplishes a lot. Let's just say.
Yeah. But also I think like, I'm glad that opening is there because I think it really sets a tone. And I feel like if I were watching this in the theater in 1975, I would be like, oh, this is the kind of movie I'm in for. Even if I'd read that it's like about the Holocaust, I would be like, okay, this is like different. And I should be ready to be like shocked or provoked. Mm-hmm. Like, I think she's not playing around with what she's doing, which I think is like so, so bold and so
impossible. She's an impossible film. She's an impossible filmmaker. And, you know, when you say that, Emily, it reminded me of like, well, it sets it really apart from a film like The Great Dictator, which is Charlie Chaplin, made in the 40s while Hitler is coming to power and is 100% comedy. It doesn't have those newsreel scenes, albeit it would have been impossible to do, of, you know, the actual atrocities. It really does set it apart.
But you know what I found was interesting when I was like researching and I was watching those intros for her at the Oscars was that like Greta Gerwig said her feminism isn't dry, it's naughty and it's playful, which I found like really accurate to what she's doing.
Yeah, she's a mischievous, you know, because provocateur.
It's just interesting to think about, like, how masculine her movie is. And, like, was that the reason why she was able to cross over and was able to get this 100%. Nomination?
I 100% say yes, because this is not a nomination that went to Hester Street, even though that film was critically acclaimed. And not, you know, Jean Dielman had a lot of attention at film festivals, but was never going to garner an Academy Award nomination. This was digestible by male critics. And I'm sure that's why Pauline Kael kind of hated it. I get why Pauline Kael hated it. I'd be curious what Pauline Kael would say 50 years later, which is impossible. But I think you're totally right that male film critics felt comfortable with this film.
And also, you mentioned this came out in 1976 in America. Mm-hmm. It was out in 75 in Italy. When you think that right down the street in Times Square, Taxi Driver was playing at the same time as this, and those were two of the biggest movies that year, I think that tells you a lot about the climate.
I think that it's very hard to talk about this film because I'm scared people are going to judge me because the subject matter is so difficult. And even though people know me and my background as being, you know, programming and writing about women directors, I'm so scared to touch Vert Mueller. I'm really glad you brought up, Emily, what Greta Gerwig said, because that makes me feel better. Like, if Greta Gerwig is on board, I'm like, okay, it's not all bad.
It is almost an embarrassing thing to be like, look, I really respect this film. I think this film is really something remarkable, but also really understand how difficult and problematic it can be considered, because it is difficult and problematic, and that's part of what makes it great.
Yeah, there's a way to make a Holocaust film like Steven Spielberg did with Schindler's List, like a film like Sophie's Choice, although it's a bit tangential, and then there's a way that Vert Mueller did it, and no one had done it up to that time, and no one has done it since. And I think, you know, it's a good thing about, like, Life is Beautiful, another Italian filmmaker, very, very different sentiment to depicting the Holocaust. I still think of her as just one of the most impossible filmmakers to digest, to synthesize what her films mean, I know what her style is, kind of. I think it's Scorsese in the documentary pointed out that everyone always compares her to Fellini because she studied under Fellini. No one had this visual style and no one had this vocabulary in Italy at the time. It wasn't Pasolini, it wasn't Leone, it wasn't Antonioni, who we're going to talk about, and it wasn't Fellini. She is wholly unique. And I think that makes it really hard 50 years later. And she's still with us. She's 93. She's still with us. She was working up until like her 90s in Italy. And we still don't know how to talk about her. That really says something interesting.
I also think the fact that her background is kind of in theater and she was doing all these like puppet shows before
much. She was a puppeteer. Thank you so much. I forgot about that.
Yeah. And so that made... The dots sort of connected for me when I was watching this movie. I was like, oh, she's like playing to the back of the theater kind of thing. Yeah. Like she's like hitting you over the head with stuff, which is so interesting also in contrast to like what was happening in the 70s with sort of like this like more like realism and these like hardcore stories that coming out of America.
Which is literally the next movie we're going to be talking about. Sits in that same vein. Yep.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just really fascinating. I am upset that she doesn't like to call herself a feminist, but I also know a lot of other people that I think are like the most feminist people in the world.
Claire Denis won't do it to this day.
Dolly Parton even like is not sure to call herself a feminist when I'm like, she's one of the most feminist people I've ever heard of. And the thing I think about it is like feminism is to me both in word and action. And I think like, the action is what matters the most to me. And like, so someone like Dolly Parton, she's putting into action her feelings and thoughts about women. And I do feel like in a way by like making like a male character or like centering male characters that are idiots, like that is a sort of feminism because you're like, look at how stupid men are.
Cue Elaine May and Ishtar and Mikey and Nikki and all of her films.
I don't know. I like when men are a little bit like, not dumb, but like they're not good. Like, I don't, when they're like the hero of their story and they're like supposed to be perfect, I'm not interested because I don't believe that that's how men are. But when they're complicated and they're idiots and they're risk takers and they're like doing stuff that is not right, like, I'm interested because that feels like reality that,
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, that's lived experience.
Yeah. I also yes. find that word anti-hero problematic mm-hmm. because I think, I mean, we don't say anti-hero generally when it comes to women.
No, we yeah. say femme fatale, which is
that's right.
highly problematic.
And that's a good place to take a break. When we come back, we're going to look at a movie Jack Nicholson loved so much, he had the rights included in a severance package for a deal that fell through. And then he was instrumental in it being released in a digital format in 2003, which is why we have it today. That's coming up after the break.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In 1972, China was reintroduced to the West after Nixon's visit to reestablish diplomatic ties with that country. It's a whole pretty complicated story on how that all went down. There's literally an opera written about it. But needless to say, the Chinese government was interested in improving their image in the Western world. So they, along with Italian public broadcaster RAI, decided to hire famed Italian director Michelangelo Antonioni to film a documentary showcasing communist China. Now, if you're familiar with Antonioni's work, which I know Alicia is, and I'm very excited to talk to her about this today, you might be surprised that they chose him. It can be pretty provocative stuff. And the film he produced, Cheng Ku, which from my understanding, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, is a Chinese term for China, meaning center of the world. And this film is gorgeous. He shot for 5 weeks, and in the end, he had a 3-hour, 3-part travelogue narrated by himself in Italian, with the only Mandarin you hear being ambient conversation. And he shows acrobats performing these amazing stunts, a tea house for Communist Party elders, Tai Chi in the park, and in the most disgust and, quite frankly, disturbing moment, a woman receiving a cesarean with supposedly only acupuncture as anesthetic. It's as graphic as you think it is. It screened in Italy for Chinese diplomats who originally seemed pleased with the results. And then there was a change in leadership for the Communist Party, and the film was denounced as anti-Chinese propaganda.
May I jump in and just point out something? Yes, this failed. Definitely see it. The change in the party then led in 1983 to the Chinese government deciding that the American emissary that would make China look great would be Big Bird. So they sent they sent Big Bird to walk the Great Wall of China in 1983 as and it's on YouTube. Just if you think Antonioni's China thing was interesting, I'm telling you, Big Bird visits China. I actually got what I think what they wanted Antonioni to produce and didn't because he's too artistic. It was accomplished 8 years later by Big Bird.
Well, the big complaint that they had was that they said, and this was published by the Peking Review in 1974, the big issue was that he was showing China as like a backwater community and he was ignoring the parts of China that are great. So, for example, he was sent to film a school that had a number of workers and was very modern. And he ended up filming the kids reading outside a derelict house outside the street. That's what made the cut.
Sure.
So, you know, I do get it.
But that's what's interesting, right? That's what someone like Antonioni is going to fix his camera on. The idea of sending Antonioni into a propagandic filmscape, I'm just like, what were you thinking? Let's send Terrence Malick to make an infomercial on something.
And this, I think what's so bonkers to me is that then the backlash against Antonioni. So in Beijing, there were literally posters of him on the streets, like with swastikas posted over his face. Yeah. This 1973 Venice Film Festival was protested both by China and Italy, Italy's communist parties. And like they had to hold people back in the streets. It almost got violent. And Antonioni's response was, he was like, I was a resistance fighter under the fascist regime. I was almost killed for that. I'm not a fascist. Like, this is really horrifying. Yeah. Now, we need to keep all that in mind, because the very next film he made is The Passenger, also known as Profession Journalist, which essentially is about Jack Nicholson ending up in way over his head while making a documentary in a foreign country, which is like, oh boy, oh boy. Let's talk The Passenger, guys. Who's got a plot summary on this one?
I can do this. I'm known for my long-winded plot summaries. And if ever there was going to be one that was going to be long-winded, it's going to be this one. But I've worked on keeping it short. Jack Nicholson plays David Locke, who goes to Chad in Africa to make a documentary. His hotel room neighbor is a man by the name of Robertson, who dies of natural causes, a heart attack, something like that, in his room. Nicholson's character discovers the body, decides to impersonate him for reasons to the viewer that are completely unknown. Although,
so literally when I first started watching this and I was like, hey, those two look really similar, I wonder if there's a reason for that in the casting. And then it's like, oh, because they're gonna change bodies, that's why.
This is the era, I guess, both in real life and in film, where you could just peel off your photo and a passport and glue the other one on and no one will notice. But these two actors do look alike, and so lo and behold, so that means Jack Nicholson's character's family think he's dead. His employers, he works for kind of like a national, like CBC-esque sort of documentary film unit, think he's dead. His wife thinks he's dead, played by Jenny Reniker from Jubilee, amazing actress. And he impersonates this Robertson fellow to realize that he is an arms dealer. So now he has impersonated an arms dealer, and he makes a deal with, I believe it's the government of gunrunners in Chad, to deliver weapons that he has no idea where they are, but he takes the money. He has Robertson's appointment book, which has appointments that take him from Chad to London, to Munich, to Barcelona, to rural Spain. This is truly, like, I love that this film is called The Passenger.
Going on a holiday?
Sort of.
Where do you want to leave the car?
I don't know.
Where are you going?
I haven't made up my mind.
This is almost a travel log. And you're seeing really interesting views of these countries and cities in the mid-70s that do not look like that anymore, especially Barcelona. And he meets Maria, a character played by Maria Schneider, who we're going to talk a lot about. They embark on an affair. He kind of tells her the truth, and she's along for the ride for some reason. And it goes very bad, as you would imagine, someone impersonating both, you know, faking their own death and also impersonating a gunrunner would go.
And his wife is also absolutely brilliant and figures out really freaking quick that, you know, Robertson is into something. And so she sends people to go figure this out. Like, he is the stupidest character in this film.
He's real dumb.
But everybody seems like, again, all the reviews I seem to read by men are like, he's just on an adventure and this is his life. And I'm like, no, he's a moron. Like,
well,
every choice he makes.
You know, it's 1975. It's Jack Nicholson. Think about films like Easy Rider. Think about also, 1975, Jack Nicholson. This is the same year as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which
You're
we
right.
talk about on the TV show a lot. And I believe he won the Academy Award for. This is a big, big year for Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
I get why male film critics were like, very used to these kind of male characters, you know, this like alienation, this isolation, and thinking it's romanticized. I think watching this film in 2021, we don't necessarily do that. It does not take away from this film at all for me. It doesn't take away from the character, because it's Antonioni and nothing matters.
God, and this film is so freaking gorgeous. My God, this movie's beautiful.
Stunning. Antonioni literally said
I
shouldn't say literally. Jack Nicholson mentioned that Antonioni's view of characters was they're just things moving through space. All that mattered to Antonioni was architecture, landscape, alienation, and kind of symbols. Like if you think about the Italian films he made before this, the Alienation tetralogy, which is Le Eclisse, La Ventura, La Notte, and Red Desert from the 60s. Yeah, nothing really happens. There's like, you know, some of them are set up to be like, you know, mysteries and you never solve the mystery and it drove critics insane. So it's just not fair to watch this film and think, I want to know why. I want it to have characterization, character motivation. It doesn't exist. It doesn't.
As you mentioned, he with his exotic travel companion played by Maria Schneider.
She's so good.
He asks her three times, why are you here with me? And there's never an answer. She's like, I just am. And she's the ethereal pixie woman.
What the fuck are you doing here with me?
Which me?
The only one I know.
He specifically is like, what the fuck are you doing here with me? And every time he says that, I thought to myself, if it's Antonioni saying, why the fuck are you watching my film? And we don't have an answer necessarily.
Nope. Also,
because it's absolutely gorgeous.
She doesn't have a name. Her name is No, she's the girl.
She's the girl.
Which yeah. I didn't even realize. Like I was like, oh, I don't think I've heard her name. And then I like looked it up and I was like, maybe I just missed it. And I was like, no, she's the girl. Okay, got it. Yeah. And like the thing about her, Maria Schneider, is just like she was known for sort of playing opposite these like older men. And like when you look at her next to Jack Nicholson, like he looks much older than her. She's so fresh faced. I like don't fully understand why she would be with him, but I also have a crush on Jack Nicholson, so at the same time I do.
I don't know why are we ever with anyone. I just, when you said that, Emily, like I don't understand why she's with him. Do you know how many people have probably said that about me?
not my current
partner, but previous partners. Like it's inexplicable sometimes.
Well, sometimes I want to wander through the grocery store, like on the street, when like you see like clearly a relationship that's going incredibly poorly. I saw this couple like screaming at each other in IKEA about the yellow does not go in the living room. Like they had like a 6-foot distance,
Becky,
and this was pre-COVID.
Becky, you cannot judge a relationship based on our reactions at an IKEA.
But all I want to do is just
IKEA
whisper gently.
IKEA is the nexus of relationship hell,
truly.
Both while you're there and while you're building.
It's because they make it so hard to get out. It's a metaphor. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
But all I want to do is just whisper at them, you can leave.
Yeah.
You can leave. You're
but
not stuck.
I think like this film, yeah, we can leave.
But yeah.
Why don't we? Why do we stay? Why is his wife even trying to find him? She's having an affair.
Well, she seems very happy with this other man.
Yeah.
So he's stimulating. He treats her seriously, obviously. They have a child.
Yeah.
She and Jack Nicholson have a child, but they never actually mention the child at any point.
I actually don't know if it's a child with his wife.
Oh, okay.
I think it could be. He does mention being a dad, but I think it actually could be like an estranged child, potentially. I will say, you know, what's important to note in this relationship, and it doesn't really get revealed until later in the film, is he's a documentary filmmaker. We see a flashback where he is interviewing like a dictator, basically, and the dictator's giving the government, you know, sanctioned bullshit responses to how well he treats the people. And his wife has come to visit him on set for one day, and she really questions him, like, why didn't you ask, you know, like the questions that the world wants to ask about, like, you know, genocide and about all of these things. And he says, well, you know, like, this is what the company told me to do. And you see the disappointment in her face, and you see the disappointment in his face when he recognizes it in her. And more so than her having an affair, that's the moment for me where I was like, oh yeah, this guy's got to switch identities fast.
And go on an actual adventure with, you know, there is something, I mean, I'm not exactly pro gun runner, I'm just going to say, but you got to have a spine to be a gun runner. Like, there's a certain amount of gumption that is required in order to run guns, especially in the middle of a revolution.
Yeah, to get involved in politics of which you know nothing about. Because, yeah, I think it's Chad is trying to stage a revolution. Can we talk about what makes this film so famous? Like, in terms, like, because it's not the plot. It's
100%. I think there's two scenes that are really like the most spoken about. Neither of them involve Maria Schneider. Emily, what did you think when you first saw those two scenes?
Are you speaking specifically like the ending is like one scene that is very remarkable, which is sort of this like long shot that reveals sort of this ending that is like
both very climatic but also anticlimactic. Like, it's like there's the camera almost like pushes through the bars, the windowed bars outside of this hotel that he's staying in, or this place that he's staying in, and it's like, it's very hard to look away. Also, you're like far away, like she's out sort of in this square talking to this man, and you feel sort of like an outsider. It's like almost that you're looking from his perspective out the window at what's happening, so you don't know enough. And then it sort of flips around, so you're looking from the outside, and you're not, you don't go, it's not traditional. Like, in another movie, you would be right there in the room with him. I'm trying not to reveal the ending, but you would be right there in the room seeing what happens quite at the end. But here you're removed, and you don't actually even see. I was impressed that, like, we didn't, like, see his dead body at the end.
Or hear a gunshot.
Or hear, like, it's very, like, soft and, like, beautiful and, like...
It is so haunting. It's, like, the one of the most haunting sequences I've ever seen in a film.
And I think it also takes on an extra meaning because the end is sort of, like, her... His wife is there and she's being asked if it's him.
Is this Debbie Robinson? Did you recognize him?
I never knew him.
You know? And so you don't actually see his face as she's speaking about it, which I think adds some power to, like, who is he now, and is he like now Robertson fully, or is he still David Locke? Like, what, who is this man, and what has he become?
If I can just for a second bring us into exactly how they did that shot, because we're still 2 years away from Steadicams.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that when you watch older films, you can be like, okay, well, that's kind of a neat shot, but like that would be super easy to accomplish with your freaking iPhone now, right? They had to shoot specifically at between 5 o'clock and 7:30 at night, because at that time there was very little difference in the lighting between indoors and outdoors. Exactly. And then the camera ran on a ceiling track in the hotel room. And then when it got outside the window, it was picked up by a hook suspended on a giant crane that was nearly 30 meters high. And the camera also had a series of gyroscopes inside so that there wouldn't be any change in between the smooth track and the mobile crane. And then the bars outside the window were fitted on hinges, and the camera comes up to the bars. They swing away at the same time, and then the hook on the crane attaches itself to the camera and leaves the tracks. And Antonioni is in a van down the block with a series of microphones and walkie-talkies so that he can explain to the crew exactly what needs to happen when.
He built the hotel, too. This isn't an existing hotel. He selected the location. It's really stunning, in a small town in Spain, because there was like an existing... It used to be a church that was across the street from a really old bullfighting ring. You actually described it really succinctly and well, Becky. But you know what I kind of pictured when I was trying to wrap my head around how did they possibly do this shot? And before I read the reality, I pictured those Fisher-Price houses we grew up with in the 80s that are all, like a hinge that you can open up like a book. Do you know what I mean? Yep. And it's kind of that idea in some ways, where you're removing part of the wall and opening up the hotel to like insert the camera. This is one of the most famous long shots in the history of film. You know, it's kind of on par with something like Orson Welles' Touch of Evil from 1958. It is unbelievable. And I don't think I was pretty won over by this film up to that point anyway. Like, it's slow and meanders, and I had a hard time with parts of the plot. I was okay with that. Seeing the sequence, which I believe is like 8 or 9 minutes, I can't be that long. It felt that long. I just sat down and I just stopped and I rewatched. It's not the final sequence. There is a shot that comes after. It's the penultimate shot. And I just sat down and watched it 3 times. Antonio's two American films prior to this, of course, are Blow Up, which I think was probably also an Italian co-production, and Zabriskie Point. So, I mean, like, to have that trilogy of Blow Up, Zabriskie Point, and The Passenger is pretty incredible. And just coming back to Lena Wertmüller, had someone given her a second chance, or the same kind of leeway that Antonioni was given for these three studio films, which were MGM, produced for Carlo Ponti, she would have reached this excellence, I feel.
Absolutely.
No question. And she would have figured out how to work in the system, and they would have figured out her, and it would have been, you know, that's how those kinds of things work. When I think the one that got me, because this one I was like, oh, how the heck did they do that in 1975? The first one that I was like, oh, that tickled me on the inside at the very beginning in the first hotel room. And it seems like it's a memory sequence with the voiceover going on of him remembering the conversation he had with Robertson. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, oh, no, he's actually got this recorded on a tape recorder. Like, that reveal is so good.
Because he's a documentarian, so you secretly record Oh, I guess it's like at one point Robertson on the audio is like, oh, are you accidentally recording this? And he's like, oh, yeah, I am. Keeps going. And you're like, oh, my God.
In India, you know, they... Hey, I think your tape recorder's...
Yes, I must have...
Still running, you know?
Yeah, so...
I guess the other... If there's a third sequence for me, I'm interested what both of you think. The execution sequence. Mm. Do we want to talk about that? Because
yeah,
it's quite the feat.
My partner and I are watching Evil Genius on Netflix right now. Mm-hmm. I had seen it previously. He had not, but we're both down a rabbit hole of true crime. Mm-hmm. And so that bit where the gentleman's collar explodes and he is killed on camera, I can't watch it. I couldn't watch it the first time.
It's a real death. It's really hard.
It's a real death. And this was kind of the same thing where I didn't expect this to happen. And watching a fictional film, I did not expect this to be what it was. And I actually asked you before we started the podcast, like, was that real? And Alicia, the answer?
Based on my research, yes. Is that 100% fact-checked and confirmed? No. I will keep working on it. But most people have said yes. It's taken from a third party, like almost newsreel footage of a prisoner execution on Lagos Beach in Nigeria, a very famed site where they conducted executions. It's a firing squad execution. It's seamlessly kind of tied as though it's like a justification for this gun running and what's going on in sub-Saharan Africa. What I read is it's an execution of a thief on Bar Beach, which is a very famed site. And it certainly looked real, but it's Antonioni, so you can never really tell, right? And coming back to Lena's film, Seven Beauties, like very different tactic, right? To show all the death, the real unsimulated death that she does in the title sequence for Seven Beauties. This is a different tactic that kind of, I think it's effective though for Antonioni to show, you know, it might not matter why Jack Nicholson's character is motivated to do these things, but the urgency of what the plot surrounds is very important.
Yeah. I will say, like, when I watched the movie, I was taken aback by the execution scene anyways. And I was like, whoa, that's really like rough and really real. And to hear that it is possibly actually real, like, is extra horrifying. And I also think, like, the rest of this movie has like this kind of like slow sort of meandering tone. And there's also this added element of like the David Locke character, even though I feel like he should be like freaked out about everything, he's like weirdly calm, which to me sort of like read as like almost like a depressed person, like a man who just like, you know, has maybe seen so much and like is sort of like numbed. But I don't know if you guys felt the same, but I felt this like detachment from him, which also sort of, I think, leads into like the passenger on a more metaphorical level. Like, we're all just these passengers on the like voyage of life, which might sound cheesy, but like truly it's like he's just going from place to place. And I don't even know that he's like fully, you know.
That's very Antonioni. Like, I think that's really well said. If you watch La Ventura, they just go from place to place looking for their missing friend, and you know they're never going to find her, and you never find out what happened to her, and they just keep traveling where they think she might have gone. She goes missing on a boat cruise. And La Nota is about a marriage that just sort of, it's not even really conflict, it's just fallen apart, and it's over one night, and you see the dissolution of the marriage occur. And Red Desert, I don't even know what it's about. I love that film so much when it's just about architecture and spaces and the alienation of the world and on the human being. But yeah, that's a really good point to me. I kind of would describe his character as like, once he decides to assume a dead man's identity, he's really the walking dead at that point. And I think that him ending up dying in a hotel room in the same position as the person whose identity he took just means like it's almost like fate in some ways. It's this weird witchiness that kind of happens in the film that is so effective.
Just to finish up, I want to bring us back into Maria Schneider and kind of where she was at. And this is going to be one of those difficult pieces. One of the reasons she got the part in this was because of the film Last Tango in Paris, which, if you are not familiar with that, it's her paired with Marlon Brando. And she was actually assaulted during that film, and it proceeded to affect the rest of her life, unfortunately. It did make her into an advocate for a lot of women's rights on camera. She really did her due diligence after that point to stand up for herself and be like, for example, for The Passenger, there was meant to be a number of nude scenes, which she refused to do. There really was this big push, as Emily mentioned earlier, to cast her with these older men. This is certainly one of them. And when she moved to the U.S. in 1975, she was actually interviewing with Roger Ebert. There's a great series of Roger Ebert interviews from 1975 when he was in L.A. And she was considering being part of a film with Robert Mitchum. And she was asked, well, or she said, well, what do you think of the chemistry would be like between me and Robert Mitchum? And Ebert answered, dynamite. And she says, yeah, but, you know, I think you're right. But like, I don't get it because I don't find these older men attractive. These are not the kind of men I go for, but I keep seeming to be cast with these men. And it's like, yeah, why do they keep doing this to you?
Yeah, it's gross. Especially because, like, it's so obvious to me that she was very talented and captivating, and I mm-hmm. feel like she could do so much more than just being sort of this, like, match for a famous man. Also, I think something interesting to consider is, like, she was, like, an open bisexual, and they kept forcing mm-hmm. her to play these roles opposite men that I think was, like, almost trying to, like, push her to be like, well, she's bisexual. But look at her with a man. It's fine. She's with a man, especially because she actually had quite a few scandals in terms of, like, there was a film where she, like, left set and she went to a mental hospital because her lover, who was a woman, was in there. Like, so she was discussing this stuff. And so it was, like, really trying to still solidify her as this, like straight sex symbol.
It's like conversion therapy in this weird
yeah
way.
And so that really, like, took me aback because she was such a badass, and I love reading about how she sort of took things back later on, but it sucks that, like, that became her narrative. And, like, someone like mm-hmm. a Marlon Brando or Jack Nicholson can go on to do 1,000 other movies where they're allowed to do whatever they want and their characters have names, you know?
On top of that, one of the facts that I thought was interesting is in the same Roger Ebert interview, she said she was talking to Jack Nicholson about she was paid $5,000 for Last Tango in Paris, and then it became this mega hit. And Jack Nicholson was like, oh, well, when Easy Rider took off, they gave me a bunch more cash. And she was like, yeah, that sure as hell didn't happen with Last Tango in Paris. So that was something I kind of read after,
you know, watching this film is she had really badly injured her back prior to doing The Passenger. So she was on very heavy pain medication, which, to Jack Nicholson's credit, he worked with her to kind of reorganize some of the filming. But a lot of the scenes, mm-hmm. If they were filming, like, after a certain time of day, like 2 o'clock, he had to kind of prop her up because she physically could not stand up without being in excruciating pain. Which is to look at her performance, which I think is really good in this film, and admire it even more. That could not have been easy at that time.
Definitely not. Just one quote from Maria that I loved. I could read about her all day, to be honest with you. But she said, never take off your clothes for middle-aged men who claim that it is art.
God damn it.
I know. I was like, that needs to be a t-shirt. Like, I would, you know, because it just... Yeah, and I love that she refused to be nude in this film, and then she refused to be nude in so many other films because she, but it just sucks that it had to get to this point where she had to feel that
way. Yeah, and there is a sex scene in this film, and she's nude, but it's tastefully done in that the camera doesn't, you know, act as a voyeur. Like, it's kind of shot from the back, so you see her bare back. It's a beautiful sequence, actually. There is a way to have a sex scene and have elements of nudity without exploiting your actress the way that Bernardo Bertolucci did to an incredible criminal extreme in The Last Tango.
And even in the 70s, I think of the Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie sex scene from Don't Look Now, which is one of my favorite sex scenes of all time. I think it's really something special. That does not feel voyeuristic at all. It feels, it's very, very tasteful. Mm-hmm.
But then Nicholas Roeg makes Bad Timing, and that's one of the hardest Art Garfunkel focus sex scenes in the history of cinema. So let's not give Roeg too much credit.
And I think that is the perfect place to end this episode. Once again, I want to thank Emily Gagné of the We Really Like Her podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun and challenging and exciting, to be honest, because I don't know about you guys, but we're still in like sort of lockdown here at this point in recording, I feel like movies are what's keeping me going, and I'm trying so hard to watch stuff that I haven't watched. So I really thank you guys for forcing me to watch stuff, and I will keep you updated on what I watch from Lena next, because honestly,
Swept Away.
Yeah. Do Swept Away.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. It's. I can give you. I'll send you an order that I feel. having been someone who's just watched 5 of her films in 6 days.
These are the kind of people that you guys get on your quality podcast. Thank you so much, Alicia Fletcher, for bringing your quality to this. It's always such a pleasure.
Thank you, Becky. I Googled like purveyors of white rimmed glasses. I don't even wear glasses, but expect to see that.
That's glasses appropriation. As someone who wears glasses, I am calling you out on your glasses appropriation for fashion purposes. Fair. When we come back next week, we're going to get into a debate over who makes a better villain, David Bowie or Tim Curry. Do you have an opinion? Because we sure do. That's coming up next week when we start our series on 1986. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us to find more great content from Hollywood Suite? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Our guests today were Alicia Fletcher and Emily Gagné. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagné. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.